Group, a nonprofit clinic helping children and youth with reading and writing problems, on the web at readinggroup.org.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen today. 30 years after the fall of Saigon to North Vietnamese forces, the Vietnam War still resonates strongly in American politics. What kind of resonance depends largely on your perspective. 40% of the U.S. population wasn't yet born when the last American helicopter lifted off the roof from the U.S. Embassy in Saigon in 1975. After the fog of a long war and 30 years of highly politicized argument, we're still debating the meaning and impact of America's experience in the Vietnam War. During this hour of Focus 580, our guest is someone who, as a reporter in Vietnam, was evacuated on one of the last American helicopters out of Saigon in 1975. Ron Yates was a prize-winning foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and he arrived in Vietnam in January of 1975 to report on the war. By that time, as many of you will recall, U.S. involvement in the war was officially over since we signed a peace treaty with North Vietnam in 1973. But America continued to support the South Vietnamese government until it fell on April 30th, 1975. Over the next hour, we'll talk with Ron Yates about his experience as a foreign correspondent in South Asia during this time and about the challenges of reporting from a war zone in a highly charged political atmosphere. Gee, I wonder if there are some parallels there today.
Could be.
As I mentioned, Ron Yates is a former foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and during his 27 years at the Tribune, he reported from Japan, Vietnam, the Philippines, South Korea, China, Thailand, Hong Kong, Cambodia, Malaysia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Mexico, and Central and South America. He has won 3 Edward Scott Peck Awards for foreign reporters, the Peter Lissiger Award for Excellence in Financial Writing, the Gerald Loeb Award for Distinguished Business and Financial Journalism, the Inter-American Press Association Tom Wallace Award for Excellence in Coverage of Latin America, the Asia Foundation Award for Excellence in Coverage of Asia, and he's been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize 4 times. And Ron Yates, by the way, is now Dean of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we're glad to have him with us. As we talk with Ron Yates, we invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, or if you're listening online anywhere in the continental U.S., the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And Ron Yates, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jack, for having me. I enjoy being here all the time.
Good. Well, you've hosted the show, too, so this is old hat.
Well, on occasion I have. They've let me come in and stumble around a little bit in the studio.
Okay, well, let's stumble on here ourselves this morning. You wrote a very moving piece in the May 1st Champaign-Urbana News Gazette about your experiences during the fall of Saigon 30 years ago. I sometimes think my days around here are tough, but, you know, after reading that, I have to say I've got it pretty easy. And it puts a lot of different things in perspective. I wonder if you could talk about that a bit, you know, what it was like. You had arrived in January 1975 and basically witnessed the fall of the South Vietnamese government.
Well, it was obviously perhaps the biggest story of my journalistic career. And when I went there in January of 1975, it certainly wasn't with the thought that I'd be covering the end of the war, because most of us felt that the war was going to drag on forever, you know. When I arrived in Saigon in January of 75, I wanted to do some stories on the whole peace treaty and how it was playing out in Vietnam, and that's what I did. I looked at the situation. We saw that even though there was supposed to be this peace accord, the war was still going on in a concerted way all over the country, especially up north in the northern part of South Vietnam. And, you know, we began to see that the peace accord was not being honored by the North Vietnamese. And the South Vietnamese themselves were just worn out, I think, at that point, just tired of it. And I had gone back and forth from Saigon to Cambodia because I was covering that story also in Phnom Penh, where the Khmer Rouge had surrounded the city and were bracketing it with rocket attacks, continually killing lots of innocent people. It was really a nasty place to be. So I was going back and forth quite a bit. But when Ban Mae Thuit fell and on March 7th of 1975, I decided I had to get back to to Vietnam because that was the bigger story for us.
Mm-hmm. And so you were in the capital, Saigon, on the morning of I guess it would have been the 29th of April as the city was basically being taken.
Right. That the 29th of April was the beginning of the end, so to speak. And at about 4 o'clock in the morning, the city came under. Well, actually, mostly the airport in Tansanut, which is about 7 miles outside the center of the city, came under heavy attack. And then a few rockets made their way into town. And I was staying at a hotel called the Continental Palace, which was an old French colonial hotel built about 1880. Great old place. And most of us stayed there because we had discovered that the owners were paying off the Viet Cong not to attack it, and it was a pretty safe place to be. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, I was jarred awake by an incoming 122-millimeter rocket and jumped out of bed, ran over to the window, opened them up, looked down. People were shooting these home guard, teenagers, really home guard soldiers were shooting all over the place, shooting up in the air. Bullets were ricocheting off buildings, and there was no reason for it because there was nobody in town. They were just terrified. They were panicked. And that began the day at 4 o'clock that morning, and the rest of the day was just an intense, really horrendous day in which I felt for sure that there would be lots of people killed and it would be just an absolute mess. As it turns out, there were very few people killed, and the evacuation went off better than anybody could have thought it would have.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was an evacuation plan, but of course it didn't really go that way.
No. No, we were told the embassy told us, we kept pressing the embassy to tell us when, how we would know the evacuation was on. And they said, okay, we will be broadcasting over the local FM station, which was operated by the embassy, by the U.S., a weather report that the temperature is 105 degrees and rising, followed immediately by the first eight bars of I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. And that would be the signal to go to your evacuation points. Well, our evacuation point was at a building along the Saigon River. So after waiting several hours, we finally got the order to go down there. We walked down and we noticed that the building was overlooked by a larger building that had twin 50 caliber machine guns on top of it and pointing right at the top of that building. And so we knew we weren't going to go out of that building. And this was because the South Vietnamese themselves, I think, at that point, I really feared them more than the North Vietnamese because they were angry. They knew what was happening. Mm-hmm. And they were going to be left behind.
Yeah. Well, this is an aspect that you write about in your piece. I think that, a lot of them felt betrayed, that, they had supported the effort and perhaps, I don't know if they'd received assurances that they'd be taken care of, but, it was, I'm sure, impossible to do that.
No, what had happened is for that month before the whole place fell, beginning around April 1st or so, Ambassador Graham Martin, who was the ambassador at the time, had implemented a plan that he called Operation Talon Vice, and that was to extract as many people, Vietnamese who had worked with the Americans as possible. But during that month, sending them out on fixed-wing aircraft, they were only able to evacuate about 37,000 of them, and which left approximately another 500,000 in the country who had worked with the Americans one way or the other. They were not going to get out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was it was obvious to us that even though they've been trying to get these people out over a long period of time, it was just a fraction of the number who needed to get out.
Now, somewhere along the line of you trying to get out yourself, you ended up at the U.S. Embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Describe the scene there.
Well, after we had gone down to the Saigon River for our first evacuation point, I decided I was going to go to the embassy to see if I could get in there. When I got to the embassy, it was surrounded by probably 20,000 people who were just pushing forward, yelling, screaming, trying to climb up on top of one another, trying to get up to the walls. The Marine guards were on top of the walls, pushing people back down, hitting them with their rifle butts. It was just an absolute chaos. And I said to myself, well, I'm just not going to try to get through mm-hmm, there because, mm-hmm. First of all, I probably couldn't. And secondly, I would feel awful climbing over these people as an American to get out. I just couldn't bring myself to do that. So I went to an alternate evacuation point, which was the University of Maryland, local sort of like external campus there in Saigon, and waited with about 50 or 60 other people. We just didn't know if we were going to get out or not, but we thought, well, that's the secondary evacuation point. We'll just wait. And that's what we did.
And eventually ended up at the airport.
Yeah, they sent a bus came along, and there were actually two buses, and there were big military buses operated by a driver, and then there's a Marine on board. And we decided, okay, get on the bus, we'll head to the embassy. So we started heading toward the embassy again, and I told the guy, I said, you're not going to get through there. There's no way you're going to get to the embassy. So he radioed ahead and got a message from the embassy saying, no, don't come here. It's impossible. You can't get in here. Go someplace else. Probably Tanzanut is your best bet. Well, Tanzanut was under real heavy attack at that point still. Lots of artillery flying in, and it was just a zoo. But it was the only place we could go because the DAO compound, that's the Defense Attaché Office, which was also known as Pentagon East, was located there, a huge complex of buildings. Concrete, reinforced steel, able to take direct hits and whatever. It was the nerve center of the military operation in Vietnam during that period. So we were told to go out there. We got to the gate of the airport. The gate was closed, and we rode up to the gate. And as we were moving toward the gate, local the South Vietnamese guards began shooting at our bus. And so the bus driver turned around. We went back out about 100 yards. He radioed ahead and said, this is a mess. How are we going to get through here? And the guy at the AO said, we just have to ram the gate. So he backed the bus up about 100 yards, floored it. We were heading toward the gate at about 60 miles an hour. And just as we got to the gate, inexplicably, they opened the gate and let us through. And as we got through, I looked over and there was a downed helicopter still lying on its side, its rotor was still turning, and I looked up and we saw a C-119, which is a large kind of a cargo plane lifting off the Tanzanut Air Base, and I was really amazed that it was able to do that because the place had been, the runway was just pockmarked with craters where it had been hit with artillery shells. He was able to get that plane up, and as he was climbing, you know, we were all kind of, I don't know, we weren't really cheering, but we were saying, wow, what, that's really amazing. And then as he began to move further away, a SAM-7, which is a missile, Russian-made missile, heat-seeking missile, rose up, hit the plane, knocked it right down, and went right down into the heart of Saigon, probably the Cho Lan district, we figured. And I thought to myself at that point, maybe I should get off the bus, walk back, and just wait in my hotel room and not go out by airplane because this doesn't look really good.
But you eventually did make it out on a helicopter.
We did. We got to the DAO compound, scrambled out of the bus. Lots of stuff happening. A lot of artillery shells landing all over the place. Saw a rocket hit the Air America compound across the street, and I thought to myself, "Well, getting inside the DAO building is probably the best thing I can do." We got inside and waited, and two or three hours later, the choppers arrived, these big CH-53 Sea Stallion heavy helicopters, which was, hold about 75 people. They arrived with some Marines. We ran out, jumped on those things, and took off and headed down what we call the Vung Tau Corridor toward the 44 ships that were waiting off the coast of Vietnam, mm-hmm. and got out that way. But it was a day you just never forget.
Well, we have a call to talk with. I want to get to one other question. I promise I'll get right to them after that. I think it's very interesting, your description of the way that South Vietnamese people or Vietnamese people in general responded to the situation. You write about trying to give some money to one of the hotel concierge staff members who you had established a rapport with. You wanted to give him some money to help him out as you were leaving. It wasn't going to do you any good. And he said, don't worry, I'll be fine. I'm VC.
Right. Yeah, it was Mr. Pham. Mr. Pham was one of the so-called boys that wore white cotton pants and coat. And Mr. Pham at the time was probably 70 years old. He had been responsible for taking care of my room and a couple of others, sweeping them out, spraying for insects ever so often, and just providing fresh water, bottled water, and things like that. Very nice, gentle old guy, and I used to see him and talk to him ever so often. He spoke a little bit of, his English was okay. He spoke better French, as most elderly Vietnamese spoke better French than they did English. And as I was getting ready to leave, I pulled the Vietnamese piastres I had in my pocket. That was the old Vietnamese, South Vietnamese currency. And as I did that, I thought, well, this is going to be worthless in about an hour or two. So I looked in my wallet and pulled out about $300 that I had and gave it to him. I said, "Dear, this might come in handy for you. Please take everything else you need in the room, you know, and you should go home. Get away from here." He said, no, I'm going to be fine because, you know, I'm VC. And I kind of thought, well, I kind of knew that he might have been, but I wasn't sure. And but he had been, you know, working there all the time. And he said, "Why don't you just stay? You'll be fine. You stay in the hotel room." And I said, "Well, I would do that, but I've got a young 4 or 5 month old daughter. I wanted to get out to see her. I hadn't been home for about 3 or 4 months, so I think I'll try to get out. If I don't get out, though, I'll be back and keep a room open for me." He said, "Don't worry, I will."
Amazing. Well, we're talking with Ron Yates this morning. He's a dean of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, was a former foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, and we're talking about his experiences in the Vietnam War 30 years ago as the war came to a conclusion. And we welcome your calls as well. We have one person waiting, and we'll welcome others. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hello, yes. Comment.
Yes.
Please, on the current conditions, like photos show, it seems like a lot of prosperity, factories and sales of appliances and stuff, tourism. But can people now start their own businesses? Can they have banking accounts, send money out, and so forth? Gracias.
Well, up to a point, I believe that the capitalism is thriving in the former South Vietnam. I mean, certainly in I call it Saigon. I can never call it Ho Chi Minh City. Mm-hmm. But traditionally, the South Vietnamese have been probably the most adept at business practices. I know that there's a lot of mom-and-pop kind of operations in South Vietnam that are doing quite well. There are major investments. A lot of the French, Japanese have come in and invested quite a bit of money in certain areas, hotels, properties along in the resort areas. But really what you're talking about is a communist system, a political system, which tolerates a certain or modicum of capitalism. So it's not the freewheeling, you know, capitalist society that you might think it is, but there is a tolerance for it, greased by the wheels of corruption most of these places. So it's not quite there yet, but it's certainly going to be a place in the future which will do quite well, I'm pretty sure.
Now, you returned to Vietnam in 1985 and again in 1995.
I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was it like and how were you treated?
Well, quite well. I mean, I went back in 85 and I remember meeting with some of the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong, that what they call the cadre, who were kind of our minders. Each of us had to be they were assigned to watch us where we went and all that, who we were talking to. And that in 85, it was much more difficult. 95, when I went back, we had complete freedom access pretty much whenever we wanted to go. And I didn't have any official minder with me. But I did notice a big difference between 85 and 95. And that is, first of all, as you pointed out, even here, I think about 60% of the population in Vietnam is born since 1975. Mm-hmm. It's a very young population. They're very keen on getting rich. You know, they talk. I had a lot of people walk up to me and say, "How can I get rich? You know, what can I do?" And I said, "Well, you know, be creative, invent something. Work hard. You know, that's how you get rich." And they were all eager to figure out a way to. They feel that America. They don't feel America owes them anything other than opportunity. They feel that. They would like to have us help them more move into this new economic arena than, they feel that we should be there being a bigger player than we already are. Now, we're not quite the player that we could be in mm-hmm. Vietnam, I don't believe.
Were you able to talk with anybody that you knew from before?
I did find, well, when I went back in 85, I remember there was a little girl named Mai, and she used to sell garlands of jasmine flowers and also things like pencils and whatever. She was one of the kids that lived around what I call Lam Sam Square. I call them the Lam Sam Square mob. And they were a bunch of about 8 or 9 kids that lived around that hotel and slept on the streets and or slept in the bars at night, wherever they could find an empty booth. They were mostly orphans. And I remember this one little girl named Mai was selling all these garlands and whatever, and I got to know her pretty well. She was probably about, maybe eight at the time, mm-hmm. in 1975. When I went back in 95, or 85, I'm sorry, I was sitting on the Continental Shelf, which was the open area of the like a veranda of the Continental Palace Hotel, and I was just having a coffee, looking out on Tudor Street and thinking about what it was like 10 years before, and she came up and pointed at me and says, "I know you." And I looked at her. I didn't know her. She says, "You wait. I come right back." And she ran off, and she came back about 15 or 20 minutes later with a copy of a story I had written about the Lam Sam Square mob back in 1995. I took a lot of pictures, and I wrote a back page for the Tribune about these kids. And she says, "This is me." And she pointed to this picture of this little girl, Mai. And I said, "My gosh, you know, she's now 18, 19 years old, so I wouldn't have recognized her." And she was still there, you know. It was amazing. It was kind of, interesting moment. But she wanted to get out of Vietnam. Apparently, her father had been an American. She was one of the half-children.
We're talking this morning with Ron Yates about the Vietnam War 30 years later, also about war reporting, the press, and the United States. And we have another caller waiting. We'd welcome others if you want to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a caller on line number one on a cell phone who has said he's a vet from 66 to 68. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I kind of appreciated the comments that puts it into perspective that the Vietnamese basically lied. I mean, I always hear this, we lost the war. Actually, I don't think we lost the war. They sat down at the peace table, signed a treaty, and then disavowed it. The other comment I would make, I was an artillery gunner in 67 through 68, and at the Tet Offensive, I was at Kontum City, and after 2 days, the third day we got control of that area and most of South Vietnam, a lot of us there really thought the war was over, and we had won or on the downhill side, and it seemed like back in the United States, from looking at different things and reading what happened there, was almost the reverse. I thought there was a dichotomy there.
That's an interesting point. You know, you're absolutely right. I remember talking with a man named Colonel Ba, who was the North Vietnamese liaison at Camp Davis, which was outside, which is inside of Tonsonut. It was the North Vietnamese / Viet Cong enclave, which was created as part of the 1973 peace treaty, which allowed them to have a presence in South Vietnam. It was an official presence. So I remember going out and talking to him once, and he said, you know, this is actually later. I'm sorry. This would be about 10 years later. I went back in 85. He told me flat out, he said, you know, the Americans really never lost a major military engagement in Vietnam, ever. I mean, they won about every engagement they were involved in, any major engagement. You know, there were firefights and, you know.
Right.
They won everything. So there's no way we could have beaten the Americans on a you know, face-to-face or face-off in Vietnam. There's no way they could do it. And then the idea of the Tet Offensive that you're talking about in 1968, you're right. It was a huge defeat for the North Vietnamese. They even admit that today.
But the North Vietnamese were in disarray,
mm-hmm.
and that was the time that we basically had taken the country. And I left in May of 68, and the Tet Offensive was the end of January, 1st of February, right at that turning point. From that point on, I was in the hospital for maybe a week and just recovering for a while and stuff. And I was able to fly and stuff around the whole country. I mean, I think I was safe in South Vietnam after the Tet Offensive. I would have been in Chicago or someplace. And it was really surprised me that you look back and said, well, we lost the war, and the Tet Offensive seemed to be a big defeat for the American side. I look at it differently, I guess. So thanks for your time.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Well, I think the comment that you relate in your story about the North Vietnamese colonel that you mentioned is that mm-hmm. he said that America lost the Vietnam War in America.
Right. And they're very astute at understanding how that played out, you know, and it was a very interesting comment for him to make because they're, you know, being brutally frank with what happened. And I think the problem was, he said, you know, the trouble is you guys, you know, you weren't really, you didn't know our country. You didn't know anything of why you were here. People were sent here to fight for something they weren't quite sure of. And if you're not committed, then how can you win a war? Well, I mean, I think the soldiers who went there fought hard. I do know that, for example, in my story, I pointed out that in World War II, the average soldier who was fighting in the Pacific over a four-year period had about 40 to 45 days of actual combat. In Vietnam, in 1 year, American soldiers had about 240 days of real combat, and that's because of the mobility of the helicopter. They were able to get them in and out and send them into more battles than they could have ever done during World War II. Mm-hmm. So it was an intense situation, and I think what's really unfair is, especially with the Vietnam era veterans, is that there's a sense or a feeling that they went over and they didn't do the job, and they were beaten, and they were very poor soldiers, and that's just not true. They were very good, and they acquitted themselves quite well. If you talk to the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong, they will tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a related question to this, and that is, some people will then say that the press is to blame because what happened is Americans' perceptions of the war in Vietnam was that we were losing and that it was, you know, a hopeless cause and it was wrong. And, of course, you had incidents like the My Lai Massacre, who, mm-hmm. You know, which was, you know, a story broken by someone actually who will be speaking here on campus tomorrow, Seymour Hersh, and that there was a lot of turmoil in America that was, you know, aided and abetted by the press. I don't know if that's the best way to put it. But, you know, as a reporter, what, mm-hmm. what do you say about that?
Well, I've asked that question. I've dealt with it quite a bit. And if you talk to most military historians or people who are, you know, former commanders in the field in Vietnam, they will tell you that it's absurd to say that the press lost the Vietnam War. That's just not true. I think what happened is that you mentioned the word perception. I think the perception in this country was that we were, you know, the operative word in those days was quagmire. You know, we're still hearing it now as it relates to Iraq. We got engaged in something we couldn't extricate ourselves from it. And, you know, I think a very good story talking about commitment, the North Vietnamese had dug incredible series of tunnels all throughout Vietnam, and probably the most extraordinary set of these tunnels were the Cu Chi tunnels, which is not too far from Saigon. These were tunnels that were 40, 60, 100 feet under the ground, and what would happen is these North Vietnamese would actually go through these tunnels for weeks, crawling, walking south, and that's why all the carpet bombing we did was ineffective. I mean, because they were under all that. And they would pop up and they would shoot at American patrols and pop down below again. And we had to send in dogs and sappers to try to root these people out. People were living in these tunnels for weeks at a time, pulling the dead down with them so that the Americans couldn't do body counts. And these dead bodies were down there just rotting away. And people were living in that kind of environment. Now, you tell me. When it comes to commitment, I mean, that's extraordinary, you know, and these people were really committed to driving out the Americans and also to taking over the South and to reunifying the country. So that's the whole idea of commitment, I think, and how strongly you feel about participating in any kind of war ultimately is the deciding factor in how long and how well you do, I believe. And I think that was part of our problem.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. And once again, I'll mention the phone numbers for others who would like to join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a Champaign County caller on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Good morning. I wanted to go back to your concierge, 74-year-old guy who said, well, I'm VC. There was an actor, and sort of emblematic for something, which is there was an actor after-action report done by either the CIA or military intelligence that said that something approaching 30% of the South Vietnamese government was actually sympathetic to at least getting the U.S. out, maybe even as far as being cadres. So the reason why Tet was such a defeat was because even though all the individual skirmishes were generally solved eventually with the cost of a lot of blood, more blood on the Vietnamese side, obviously, but the fact that they could pull off an uprising all around the country simultaneously in South Vietnam implied they had support very thoroughgoing through the whole society. And that's really where the defeat was. It wasn't Northerners coming down. I mean, there were surely some coming down, but some of those people had gone up, had fled up north, too, and were coming back. So it was really an attack on South Vietnam. And when Tet happened, people who were really watching what was happening were seeing that there were all these assurances of how things were pacifying, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was this just widespread uprising. That's what it really illustrated, was that you can't defeat a nationalist movement when it's that thoroughgoing. And that's why the media, that's the real reason why you can say the media didn't lose the war.
Mm-hmm. Good point. I think you're right. I believe that as the war was winding down, even in March, I was spending a lot of time meeting with people who were in what was so-called a so-called shadow government that had been created during the Tu regime and Nguyen Van Thieu. And these people were not necessarily communists, but they certainly were sympathetic to what the VC were trying to accomplish, because not even all the VC were really hardcore communists. They just wanted to get the country back in their control. They wanted to drive the Americans out, the French, everybody else who had been occupying the country for more than 100 years or so. And a lot of people did sympathize with not necessarily Ho Chi Minh's ideas, but certainly with the idea of this is our country, let us run it the way we want to. And I think a lot of people also began to see that all the money that was flowing into Vietnam from the Americans, from Washington, had a real corrupting influence on their society. I mean, it was a society which was propped up by the American dollar, period. I mean, it was just billions of dollars flowing in. We spent, the war cost us, about $175 billion. It was an incredible amount of spending going on, and a lot of people raking money off, sending it to Swiss bank accounts. I mean, it was just really awful, and that was another area that a lot of people were upset about, that the corruptive influence of the American dollar in Vietnam.
There is another argument that isn't widely heard, is that if you look at all of the goals that the U.S. had, it wasn't a complete failure, because it did disallow any kind of independent nationalist development, because basically the country was laid waste. From the Roman era, you can talk about Carthage having salt spread about it, whereas in our day when petroleum is king, you can just say, well, we napalmed and dioxined the place. So there's still this large legacy of that destruction that is prevented. And then between that and us not keeping up our side of the peace treaty, which also did happen, reminds me of the comedian mathematician who in England who said, I can't do comedy anymore because Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize. So anyway, I'll listen. I just wanted to make sure the Tet argument was rejoined.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks for the call. Speaking of the cost of the war, and I certainly they're still cleaning up landmines from from the 30 years ago or more.
There are hundreds of thousands of landmines all over Vietnam. People are still being killed, wounded, maimed by these things, and it's a legacy of any war where you. There are even people being killed or being, stepping on old punji sticks, which is what the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, used to use. So it's still, in many ways, a war zone. I mean, there are certain parts of Vietnam that have been completely defoliated. I mean, it's coming back, but still, it's changed the kind of animals, the kind of plants that grow there, the kind of animals that live in these areas. It's changed that a lot. And I remember going into Cambodia. And driving along a road and seeing huge craters, moon-like craters that had been created by these, 1,000-pound, 2,000-pound bombs dropped by B-52s when they were doing carpet bombing. And, you're talking about huge areas of several, miles across, just pockmarked with the 30-foot deep craters that are 30 or 40 feet across. And anything was in that area was obliterated. And those, you know, how do you farm in a crater? You know, and they have to fill those things back in. So there's a lot of, you know, the residue of war is still quite apparent in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of civilian casualties, I may have the figures wrong, but I believe it's on the order of 2 or 3 million is one of the estimates that's perhaps considered reliable. And I guess the question is, after that kind of that level of destruction, as you mentioned, and that many people, that civilians killed in a war, it's remarkable that you can go back there and they don't hate you.
No, it's amazing. I went back to a little village called Phuc Hiep, and this was a little town where I'd gone out about a week before the fall of Saigon because I had heard the North Vietnamese were very close. I wanted to go see where they were. So a couple of us went out. We got caught in a crossfire in a field, a series of rice paddies, about 10 of them, rice paddies that were stretched across an open area. And after about 20 minutes of really heavy crossfire, we got up and ran to a river, jumped across, got some farmers to row us across the river to this little village called Phuc Hiep. And there were several dozen dead North Vietnamese who had been hit with it. They'd walked across a field, and it was mined with Claymore mines, anti-personnel mines, which send out 700 steel balls in a 90-degree arc or about 300 yards, anything in that, and 6 feet high. Anything within that area gets obliterated. And a lot of them were, these 15 or so soldiers were killed. And when I went back in 95, I went back to that village. I hadn't been there for 20 years. And I began trying to remind them of this one battle that had taken place, and they all recalled the battle. And then a couple of the people recalled me as they remember me when they were children at the time, but they remember me being there. And we sat down and talked in a little hut for about an hour and a half or so. And I said, well, what's your feeling about this 20 years later? He said, well, we don't think anything about it. I mean, you know, it's 20 years ago. I have to think about my water buffalo. I've got to plant my rice. I haven't got time to think about these things. You Americans can think about those things, but we don't. And it's over. It's in the past. Now we have to go on with our lives, you know. We have to feed our families. And that's pretty much the attitude I found all over Vietnam. It's amazing that this has all been kind of put behind them, you know, and there's no residual animosity. There's none of this hatred. You Americans did this. You Americans did that. I didn't hear any of that at all.
We have about 15 minutes left during this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Ron Yates. He's Dean of the College of Communications here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He was a foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune 30 years ago during the fall of Saigon. And we're talking about Vietnam, the U.S. war and the press. And in the time remaining, we're happy to take your calls if you want to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I'm almost hesitant to segue into the comparison with Iraq, but I feel that it's a topic that is on a lot of people's minds, and certainly there have been many people who have suggested that Iraq is another example of Vietnam. So I wonder if we could talk about that, and what do you see as the differences and perhaps similarities between the two?
Well, there are huge differences, I believe, not only in terms of the geography, of course. One is a tropical country with lots of jungle. The other one is a desert, pretty much. So you've already got terrain differences, and you have different kinds of military equipment you're using. In Iraq, you can use tanks quite effectively, things like that. You couldn't do that in Vietnam very well. The other thing is, of course, an area I'm most familiar with, and that's the way the media operate. And I think that Vietnam and Iraq are totally different in terms of the way the media operate. In Vietnam, we had complete access. We went any place we wanted to go. We went to you saw a chopper getting ready to take off. You'd say, where are you headed? Or I'm going to Tay Ninh province or whatever. And I say, okay, can I go with you? And they say, sure, jump on. And off we'd go. And then you went and you took your chances. You either stayed there with them or you got back a day or two later. But you could go anywhere you wanted to go in Vietnam. I mean, it was at your own peril, and you went. In Iraq, we know that American or correspondents are now embedded with military units, and they can only go where those military units go. So their view of the war, I think, is much narrower than what we had in Vietnam. At least I could go one day here, another day there, another day over here, and I had kind of a broader picture. But if you're with one unit, you're only getting a slice of that story. So I believe that the media picture is quite different from what it used to be in Vietnam. And I'm not saying that the reporting is bad coming out of Iraq. It's been quite good, as a matter of fact. And I've been impressed with people who haven't had any war experience, learning very quickly how to cover a war. I had one advantage when I was in Vietnam. I was in the military. I knew how to use weapons, and I spent 4 years in the Army, so I knew something about tactics, about the kind of things you need to do to survive. And a lot of the reporters in Iraq have never had that experience. So right away, they've got a steep learning curve.
In addition to the fact that reporters are embedded with units, technology has obviously opened up, you know, worlds of difference between, you know, then and now. I mean, you know, you said you carried a manual typewriter and you had to file stories by pigeon. Is that
right?
What you said?
Well, we call it pigeoning. In other words, if I went up to a place like, just take for example, I was up country in a place called Nha Trang, and I'd flown up there on a South Vietnamese helicopter. And landed, and the guy took off and said, okay, I might be back, I might not be back, but, you know, I said, okay, never mind, we'll get back on our own if we have to. And while we were there, I had to figure out how to file my stories. There was no telephone service where I was staying. So what you would do is you'd write a story and then take it to the airport, hope there was an Air America pilot or some pilot flying back to Saigon, and you would give him the story and say, take this to the public telephone and telegraph office, give it to Ms. Ha, and she'll punch it for me on a telex and send it back to the Tribune. And that's what you call pigeoning a story out. You give it to a pigeon who happens to be a pilot. And when you got back to Saigon, you'd look the pilot up and go out and buy him a couple of beers or dinner. And that's how you did it. That was the only way to get a story out in those days. And now, of course, you've got satellites, you've got cell phones, you've got wireless modemed laptops. You've got just amazing kinds of equipment, iridium telephones and things like that, which really gives you tremendous capability to file and send stories from almost any place you are.
Well, I mentioned Iraq, and suddenly the phone lines filled up. So let's go on and talk with some callers. We have someone, I believe the next up is Champagne, line number one. Good morning.
Hi, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and in Saigon one time when I was there, we used to get a newspaper that consisted of one legal sheet, a blank sheet of paper printed on both sides. I will never forget one article I read. I read it again. And the third time, there was totally no doubt. It was about a large anti-government riot the preceding day. I read it three times because I had walked through that riot in uniform, by myself, unarmed, and I did not realize it was a riot. It was junior high school children at recess playing soccer, tag, jumping rope, and doing the things that young children do. Three of the young children burned 1 liter of gasoline. That was the riot. Is there any reason I distrust the press and their reporting of war stories?
Who published this? Do you know who it was?
It was either AP or Reuters. It was little blurbs, the nature of the two columns you see in the Wall Street Journal every day. Hmm. You know, just a little short one-paragraph things. And this was actually a fairly long article for the legal length sheet of paper that covered world, national, and sports news.
Hmm. I don't know what to tell you. I think it's pretty bad if somebody is reporting something that didn't happen. Obviously, you shouldn't be. If that were to happen, you would normally, if you're caught, you'll be fired. I mean, that's not something you should be doing as a reporter.
Mm-hmm. Your sense of professionalism of the reporters. I mean, I'm sure you knew many others who were reporting from Vietnam.
I think most of the reporters that I knew there, the thing about Vietnam is anybody could go to Vietnam and become a reporter. You just had a letter of accreditation, a letter from some organization saying, yes, we will buy this person's stories or we'll buy this person's pictures or film. Mm-hmm. In those days, it was film.
Yeah.
It wasn't video.
Right.
So if you had that letter and also something said, and we will also be responsible for any debts, then you could get a military assistance command press card, which gave you access to the PX and all these other things you wanted to have access to, and you could be a reporter. And so a lot of people were showing up in Vietnam who had no experience, just freelancers. And so there's that group, all right? And I, some of those people were on the margins. You know, they had no training. They might have written something like this man was talking about. They saw something and weren't quite able to understand what was actually happening, didn't speak the language, so they make a mistake. But for the most part, I think the reporters in Vietnam were quite good, and I know they risked their lives. I mean, more than 75 of them were killed covering that war, which is more than any other war in our history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have several of the callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Line number 4 next in Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you had the same restrictions back in Vietnam that they have today. Could you have found out about the My Lai massacre or anything like that?
I mean, the restrictions in Vietnam, there were really none. If you were there, you saw something, you reported it. Now,
if you had the same restrictions then that you have now.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Well, absolutely. I mean, unless you were there when the unit did this, if you happened to be a witness and you were embedded with that unit, then you would have seen it, then it would have been your responsibility probably to report it. But you're right. I mean, I don't know if any. If you had the same kind of restrictions placed on you today that were, in those days back in Vietnam, I'm not sure you would be able to report a My Lai.
Because I don't know, maybe something like that is going on in Iraq and we don't know it.
Well, it's possible. Some of these things happen. Maybe that's something to ask Cy Hirsch when he's here. He's the one that disclosed the My Lai massacre story, which I think came after the fact by soldiers who wanted to talk about it.
Well, yeah. Just one more thing and then I'll let you go. If we were to have a problem in Korea, how do you think we'd do?
Well, it'd be there would be some difficulty because the Americans on the Korean Peninsula, about 34,000 of them, are nothing more than a tripwire. And if the North Koreans come south, there's no way we're going to stop them, and that'll just get us engaged in the war there. But so that's a very dicey, very dangerous place, the Korean Peninsula. I think it's one that's probably one of the most dangerous places in the world, along with the Middle East.
Yeah, it's not Iraq. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Just a quick follow-up. Do you think it's fair to say that the handling of media access to certain areas and certain images has been as a result of lessons quote-unquote lessons mm-hmm. from what the press covered in Vietnam?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things if anybody remembers this, sitting in your living room during the 5:30, 6 o'clock news, you saw constant pictures of flag draped coffins, mm-hmm. Americans coming home from Vietnam in coffins. And it was a horrible thing to have to look at day after day. I think it was only recently that the Pentagon allowed coffins coming back from Iraq to be filmed. I mean, they had banned that. They didn't want Americans to see that kind of thing. And so I think there are a lot more restrictions placed on the media, what they want you to see, what they want the public to see. And, I believe that's a part of trying to manage the image of the war, mm-hmm. And that's what they're pretty good at doing it. They learned a lot from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We just have a couple minutes left, and there's a lot we can talk about, obviously. You've covered a number of wars, including Central America and you were in Cambodia during the fall of Phnom Penh, which we didn't really talk much about and actually hardly mentioned. Do you think that war reporting has changed since the Vietnam War in any significant way in terms of the way news organizations regard their obligation to report the news? Are they doing a better or worse job, or is that too simple a way to ask the question?
Well, let's see. I think probably, for one thing, it costs more money, I think, probably today to cover the wars because of the technology involved. The fact that right now in Iraq, every reporter I know from MSNBC, I was talking to when Rick Kaplan was here as president of MSNBC, said every reporter has two security people. You've got to go out in armored vehicles. Sometimes I covered the war in a Volkswagen when I was in Vietnam, sometimes in an open-air Jeep. I had no security person around me. I just went out and did what I had to do. It's much more expensive today to cover war than it used to be. So news organizations are thinking about the relative cost. Is it worth it to be covering this particular conflict? Are we just putting our reporters in harm's way for nothing? And, of course, Iraq is I'm separating Iraq from that equation, because Iraq is definitely going to be covered, and so will Afghanistan be, though you don't hear much about Afghanistan these days, even though it's still an ongoing hot kind of a situation. But I believe that a lot of news organizations are having to think about costs, insurance costs for their correspondents. And I also believe that a lot of them have put their reporters through training programs so that they know something about the military, and that costs money. So all these factors have to play out. If you're a foreign editor thinking about how you want to cover a conflict, the cost factor is really important, especially in this era of the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. And is it you mentioned that you had experience in the military yourself, and that served you very well in terms of, you know, your ability to deal with the very dangerous situations. Is that something that perhaps is lacking in current war reporting?
I think so. I think a lot of very few, if any, of the reporters covering Iraq have had any military experience at all. I mean, I knew I could pick up an M-16 and I could fire it and field strip it and put it back together, an M-14, M-1. You know, I knew all these weapons, and I felt if I needed to, I could defend myself. I never had to, but sometimes I thought I was going to have to, but I never had to. And I think beyond the weaponry, knowing the tactics, how you read a battlefield, what's happening. The sound of an incoming, and how much time you have before you have to start running for cover. You know, all these kinds of things you learn intuitively after you do it for a while, but it was really helpful to know that stuff in advance.
Okay. Well, we've got an incoming afternoon magazine program we have to make way for, so we'll have to end there. We've been talking with Ron Yates, Dean of the College of Communications. He was a foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune for some 27 years, including 30 years ago during the fall of Saigon to the North Vietnamese, and it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Jack. I'm glad to be here.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
That's it for Focus 580 for the day. Time to hand things off to Jay Pierce, hosting the afternoon magazine.
Thank you very much, Jack. And this afternoon, we will be having the usual assortment of news and features in the noon hour. And then in the 1 o'clock hour this afternoon, we will open up the telephone lines, and you can call in and ask whatever questions you have on your mind about WILL Radio, AM and or FM, as we talk to the manager. That'll be coming up.